This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
And with that, you've been listening to a rebroadcast of the evening news here on listener-supported, non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City, which means that, with any luck at all, it is time for the next show, which is coming up now at exactly midnight, which is this. Right?
Right. Moorish. Orthodox. Radio. Crusade. Anarchism for the global city. Radical environmentalism for the concrete jungle. Esoteric explorations of the secret history of rebel culture. The Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. Every Tuesday at midnight after the news, only on listener-supported, non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. Be there.
Oye, y ese pito.
Así se goza.
All right, opening up with some more New Yorican funk here on the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. On listener-supported, non-commercial, WBAI 99.5 FM here in New York City. And let's see, that was, who was that? That was the Joe Cuba Sextet with something called El Pito, which just means the whistle. And according to the liner notes, none of the band members had ever been in Georgia. So I guess it just must be some kind of artistic statement or something, right? But what a great little tune. And that is from a compilation called the New Yorican Funk Experience, Salsa Caliente de New York. New York spelled N-U. And let's see, that is from the Nascente label. And we're continuing, obviously, in the same groove as last week. Continuing with the New Yorican funk thing. And we're continuing in a New York City theme, generally. Because, very interesting, last week we had on these representatives from the what was the name of the group? From the Coalition to Protect Chinatown / LES on the super development of Lower Manhattan and the rezoning controversy, as well as some of their allies from Sunset Park out in Brooklyn, talking about the rezoning controversy out there as well. And then, lo and behold, the very day after the show, it actually actually hit the headlines. And I was very gratified to see that the city council chambers were packed and people were making some noise about the rezoning of 125th Street. Because usually, you know, you talk about zoning and people just kind of zone out, you know. I mean, that's what I started the show saying, is that you know, you talk about zoning and people just think you're one of these urban infrastructure geeks and they zone out. But actually, we got a very, very favorable reaction from that show last week. And I guess people actually do care about this issue and are starting to wake up to the fact that, you know, we're losing our city. We are very, very rapidly losing our city. You know, and it really makes me very sad how quickly we're losing it. Very, very fearful for the future. Anyway, so here, this is from the Gotham Gazette from April 30th, the day after we were last on the air. Quinn kicks public out. In the first significant disturbance since the Viola Plummer incident, Council Speaker Christine Quinn ordered the balcony of the council chamber to be cleared this afternoon, April 30th, after a large group of Harlem rezoning opponents and supporters created a so-called disturbance. The council approved the rezoning by a vote of 47-2, with members Charles Barron and Tony Avella dissenting. Quinn's move was criticized on the floor by several representatives, including council member Helen Foster, who said if they are going to close the meeting to the general public, which is what they essentially did, since the only people allowed on the council floor are staff members and press, they should do it for any disturbance, whether it is cheers of approval or heckling of dissent. Equal treatment must be given to all groups, she said, and the council must ensure it does not eject anyone, quote, based on color, unquote. We have set a bar here today, said Foster. Let's see. Noticeably disturbed by the heckling, Councilmember Inez Dickens, who represents the represents majority of the 125th Street throughway, challenged the perception that Harlem lost out in the zoning, which will require 46% of housing be income targeted, while calls of sellout sailed down from the chamber's second-story balcony. Dickens said, I don't need anyone to document my commitment to my community. I was born and raised in Harlem. end quote. It is not unusual for catcalls to come from the council's balcony. Similar disturbances have occurred over the past year to varying degrees, most recently during the Columbia University rezoning. This is the first occasion in Quinn's tenure as speaker that the balcony has been cleared. Clearing the chamber is allowed under the city council's rules, which state 3.10, order decorum. The presiding officer shall preserve order and decorum. In the event of disturbance or disorderly conduct in the chamber, lobby, or gallery, the presiding officer may cause that same to be cleared. The state's open meetings law is mute on whether government bodies can close meetings based on disturbance. Exemptions in the law would not apply to this incident. So a little bit of undemocratic action there by Christine Quinn. And right on to the residents of Harlem who showed up and raised a voice of protest about their community being taken away from them. And, you know, it's very interesting that on both sides, they're saying, oh, we're not happy. We're having to give up too much. Right. I mean, here you've got, you know, council member Inez Dickens saying that, you know, that it's ultimately going to be good for Harlem's 46% is going to be income targeted. Well, you know, we deconstructed all of that on the last radio show. And of course, I'm sure most of our listeners understand that, you know, the actual low income housing actually isn't low income housing by the standards of most of us. It's very similar to what just happened, was it yesterday, at the rent control guidelines board, where, you know, both sides were jumping up and down about how, you know, the people on the board had sold out to the other side. And the tenants were all saying that they'd sold out to the landlords by giving too much of a rent hike, up to 7%. They're going to make the final decision in June, but it's the window goes up to 7% for a yearly lease, which is pretty significant, I would say. And, of course, you know, the landlords is, you know, wringing their hands about how oppressed they are by this socialist bureaucracy here in New York City. and how, you know, there shouldn't be any limits on rent at all is ultimately what they would like. So, I mean, that's what they're always lobbying for up in Albany, to get rent control done away with entirely. So, you know, this is kind of how the game is played, right? I mean, you know, the development lobby makes unrealistic demands, makes maximal demands. So then when they have to get what it is that they realistically can get, then, you know, they say, oh, you know, we didn't get what we want and we're being oppressed by this outdated socialistic bureaucracy. And when we, you know, we meaning tenants and real, you know, old school New York types, we are beating back straw men of the maximal demands of the development industry. We, you know, lose and we just sort of breathe a sigh of relief that we didn't lose even more than we actually did. And so each time the industry asked for a little bit more and they get a little bit closer to their maximal demands, and yet they complain about how oppressed they are. So it's not difficult to see where all of this is leading, is it? So, there's been a few other things in the news since last week, which have given me a sense of foreboding. And let's see, by the way, you know, there's a similar controversy which is going on in San Francisco at the moment, where, you know, I was just out there a month ago, and sort of been following the parallel struggles which are going on out there. Here, this is from the San Francisco Chronicle of May 1st. Trans Bay plan would sprout new SF skyline. A cluster of skyscrapers rivaling the Transamerica Pyramid, which is the highest skyscraper in San Francisco, would rise around the West Coast tallest tower, the Transamerica Pyramid, under an ambitious proposal that would shift the heart of San Francisco's downtown south of Market Street. The city's rezoning plan, unveiled Wednesday at a packed public meeting, would allow as many as 7 new skyscrapers to surpass the current 550-foot height limits in an area surrounding the planned Trans Bay Tower, a high rise of roughly 1,000 feet adjacent to the new Trans Bay Terminal at First and Mission Streets. So, let's see. The Board of Supervisors and Planning Commission would have to approve the zoning proposal, which is likely to be required in response to revised in response to public comments. But planners argue that taller skyscrapers would create a more dynamic skyline and are needed to meet the city's projected demand for office space, blah, 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 blah. So let's see. The new Trans Bay Tower would make room for at least, in addition to the new Trans Bay Tower, the proposal would make room for at least 6 towers in the 600 to 800-foot range on selected sites along Howard and Mission Streets, a logical extension of the city's downtown plan. That 1985 rezoning sought to preserve historic buildings north of Market while steering growth south into what was then a moribund area. For people who are familiar with their San Francisco geography here, let's see. So this is going to essentially be, they were trying to preserve the more historic area north of Market and push the high rises into the sort of post-industrial area south of Market. But now it looks like they're going to be lifting the height limits north of Market as well, near as I can understand what's going on there. So, it's happening. It's happening all over the place. And it just, makes me wonder. My two favorite cities in the United States, New York and San Francisco, and it seems like we're kind of, losing them both to super development and utterly, transforming both the physical skyline as well as the more significantly the culture. And the most obvious thing, of course, is that with more development, the rents go up, and it isn't, merely that the working people are being pushed out of New York City, but there's a whole sort of that goes along with that. There's a whole sort of cultural shift which takes place, where people come to New York. A lot of people come to New York, not just to make money. A lot of people do come here to make money, whether they come here to make money to survive, or they come here to make a lot of money off the stock market. Yeah, obviously a lot of people come here to make money, but more significantly, a lot of people come here to make money doing what they want to do, or not even to make money, but simply to do what they want to do. People come here because they want to be artists and writers, intellectuals, and all that sort of thing. And that, sort of depends, bohemia, if you will, that sort of depends on people having a little bit of cultural elbow room, which is dependent on, for starters, on free time, which means that you aren't, running on the corporate treadmill to make a buck so you can, throw half or, three quarters of your salary, at the landlord, right? Because if you do that, then you don't have any time to be, an artist or an intellectual or a bohemian. So, the romance of New York City, which actually did, has brought a lot of people here over the years, is, it's being destroyed. They're killing the goose that laid the golden egg. And, New York is becoming more and more like the rest of the country. It's becoming suburbanified. Kmart and all these, suburban type, big, like, shopping mall chain stores are moving into the city. You know, the suburbs are coming back and colonizing the inner city. As, you know, happened in the 1990s with Disney taking over 42nd Street. So, you know, Giuliani, who is lauded for having made the city safe and livable again, actually, you know, I see him as somebody who really hated New York City and hated New York culture. And I saw him as like, you know, the suburbs' revenge on the inner city. You know, all during the urban decay, so-called, of the 1970s, there was this whole white flight phenomenon where people, you know, fled, including people of Giuliani's generation. Remember, he was born in Brooklyn and he grew up out on the island. You know, people fled, people of economic means, fled the inner city for the suburbs. And Giuliani represented the recolonization of the inner city on, you know, the part of all of those, you know, bourgeois white people who had fled in the beginning in the late 1960s on through the late 1970s, early 1980s. You know, this was their revenge. So it was almost like literally the revenge of the suburbs on the urban center. And, you know, now Bloomberg is essentially continuing with his program, although, you know, albeit with a somewhat more of a smiling face as opposed to a scowl. And he doesn't, you know, come across like a tough cop, but he's still got Kelly as commissioner. And we just saw, you know, with the Sean Bell verdict that the NYPD pathologies, which persisted notoriously in the Giuliani era with Amadou Diallo and Abner Louima and so on, continue, unfortunately, and the impunity that goes along with that culture apparently seems to continue. You know, more significantly, that's sort of the terror, the state terror, which is the de facto enforcement of the changing class nature of New York City, right? But the more fundamental change, which I would argue, you know, lies behind the state terror, or of which the state terror is an instrument, is the changing of the class nature, which is tied to the development blitz. And certainly, I mean, that has only advanced under Bloomberg. It hasn't slowed down at all. Only advanced. And on the subject of suburbanization, well, did anybody happen to see the story in on the subject of the corporatization of New York City and just turning it into, you know, a sterile corporate entity? Did anybody happen to see the story in the sports section, which I hardly ever read? I don't even look at the sports section, but there was actually a pretty interesting article in it, which really didn't have that much to do with sports, Newsday on Sunday, on May 4th, where Fred Wilpon, who is the, if I'm pronouncing his name correctly, who is the owner of the Mets, was waxing eloquent about about his nostalgia for Ebbets Field, where the Dodgers used to play in Brooklyn back in the day, until they left the city in 1957. And how he was saying that, he grew up going to Ebbets Field, and he's confident that, that the new Mets stadium that they're building is going to, quote-unquote, revive memories of Ebbets Field and give fans a special connection. And he's going to, you know, bring back the romance of, you know, what was the Brooklyn Dodgers in Ebbets Field. And, you know, nowhere in this story do they point out the bizarre irony that, you know, that this new Met Stadium is going to be called City Field. And that's not City, C-I-T-Y, but City, C-I-T-I, as in Citibank, of course. So, you know, I mean, Ebbets Field was named after a, it had been a, it had been an actual airfield before it was a ballpark, but I'm not quite sure where the name Ebbets came from. You know, I mean, who the hell was Shea anyway? Shea was some big shot lawyer who helped get the stadium built back in the day. So, all right, well, Shea was not a particularly inspiring name. Okay, now Yankee Stadium, all right, it's named after the team at least, right? City Field. Do you think that there is ever going to be any kind of sense of special connection, as Fred Wilpon puts it? Any sense of, you know, romance to something called City Field? And, you know, of course, this is just following, you know, out in Coney Island, where they're also doing this new development blitz, and they've cleared out much of the old amusement park there. They've also got a Keyspan Park out there. One named after a bank, the other named after a utility. But, you know, at least Keyspan Park is for the minor leagues. You know, I mean, City Field is for the major leagues. And, you know, I mean, it scares me to think. And, I mean, I was never a huge baseball fan. But, you know, when I was a kid, I used to go to Shea Stadium once in a while. My brother was a big baseball fan, and I would tag along with him sometimes. You know, obviously for a lot of the kids in the neighborhood, you know, the neighborhood being Jackson Heights, just a couple of, two, three stops in the 7 train away from Shea Stadium. You know, going to Shea Stadium and, you know, rooting for the Mets meant a lot. And what is it going to mean for the next generation of kids who are going to be, you know, not going to Shea Stadium and rooting for the Mets, but going to City Field and rooting for the Mets? All right, now, am I just, you know, just too old-fashioned and making more of this than is really there? All right, so we've got a City Field, and we've got a Keyspan Park, and, okay, the other thing which, the other news thing which I heard over the weekend concerned, you know, on the subject of, you know, once again, the suburbanization of New York. They're opening an IKEA in, you know, the furniture outlet, big, you know, box store, suburban style IKEA furniture outlet in Red Hook. And, you know, that's not such good news as it is, right? But what really got under my skin is that the bus, which is going to be going out there, it's going to be the IKEA bus. That's what it's going to say on the front of the bus. It's not going to say Red Hook. It's going to say IKEA. So once again, you've got this sort of, place names are being, appropriated by private corporate interests. So we've got a City Field, we've got a Keyspan Park, and now, you know, it seems that, you know, Red Hook is being insidiously renamed IKEA, at least by the MTA. It's actually going to say on the bus, it's not going to say Red Hook, it's going to say IKEA. It's going to be the IKEA line, not the Red Hook line. So, you know, this says something about our culture and the way our culture is changing. It says something really, really scary, I think, about the way our culture is changing and about the way corporations are just taking over everything. And we already know that, you know, they're taking over how we get our food, and they're taking over, you know, how we get our information, and, you know, it's all being consolidated. We understand that. But what's even scarier is the way that, you know, they're sort of insidiously colonizing our culture. And even, you know, the very sense of geography and personal identification and special connection, as Fred Wilpon put it, right here in the city where we live. To me, there's something sort of uniquely creepy about this, okay? And this gets into the question of, All right, before I move on to the next part of the rant here, I should mention that it's 12:32 in the morning on listener-supported, non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. And this is the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade, and my name is Bill Weinberg, and we are talking about New York City. I'm in the middle of a rant. People are trying to call in, but I'm not taking phone calls now. We're going to take phone calls when I finish my rant and we hear a little bit more music. So everybody's trying to call in. Don't bother. Call in a half an hour. For the last half hour of the show, from 1 to 1:30, we'll take phone calls. And I do want to hear what people have to say about this, so hold that thought, okay? If you're afraid you're going to lose that thought, just, you know, get a pen and paper and write down a note to yourself so you'll be ready to go when we do take phone calls in exactly a half an hour. Okay. Now, you know, I thought long and hard about this congestion pricing thing. And initially, I was for it because one of the things which is, you know, destroying New York, of course, is the cult of the private automobile, right? And already, you know, the cult of the private automobile has done a great deal of damage to New York City. People who've read The Power Broker, Robert Caro's memoir of Robert Moses, will understand that, you know, that's really how the South Bronx was destroyed in the 1960s by the Cross Bronx Expressway, which just, you know, completely, just ruthlessly cut through the heart of what had been, you know, a thriving immigrant community. And sort of, you know, started to make the city more like, you know, L.A. and the monster dysfunctional sprawl cities of the American West. The congestion, you know, is a serious health problem. You know, in terms of, you know, just the getting around on your bicycle, all right, it's extremely dangerous. And on top of that, you know, it's our air quality continues to lag behind minimum federal standards. And then, you know, there's the noise, and I don't have to go on about it, right? Serious, it's a serious problem, without a doubt. And, you know, we've tried to advocate here on these airways, we tried to advocate some, you know, fairly radical grassroots solutions in terms of making things more livable in New York City for bicyclists and pedestrians. And actually, this is a city which has got a lot of potential for people getting around by the power of their own feet. Initially I was thinking, yeah, well, anything which is going to help keep cars out of New York City is going to be a good thing. And I was just kind of like on the congestion pricing bandwagon, but ultimately I turned against it for three reasons. And, I'm going to start going from the most blatant to the most insidious. And the most blatant, of course, the most obvious, which occurred to me immediately, and what I always sort of had a little bit of mixed feelings about it, is the class angle. Is that, you know, it's going to disproportionately hurt working people, you know, the ones who can least afford it. You know, people who live in such a locale, you know, whether they're coming in from somewhere in Jersey or something, or the island, you know, where they live in such circumstances that they have to take their car to the city. Or, you know, if you've got a business out in Queens and you've got to make runs into the city to make deliveries, I should say into Manhattan, to make deliveries, you know, that kind of thing, you know, and it's going to cost you, $4 every time, what was the sum again, to every time that you want to come into Manhattan, or have to come into Manhattan, you know, that's going to really eat into people's pocketbooks in a way which really discriminates against people of lesser means. So immediately there was the class angle, that it was a solution which was going to be disproportionately born on the backs of the working class. All right, that's the first thing. Secondly, there was the surveillance angle. It became evident that the congestion pricing thing was going to be enforced by in addition to some kind of a, easy pass type magnetic strip reading technology. There are also going to be new surveillance cameras put up in Midtown. Lots of new surveillance cameras put up in Midtown to read license plates. And, of course, they're already putting in the so-called security veil down here in downtown in the financial district. And this was just going to be like another, you know, insidious means of sneaking in a surveillance veil in Midtown as well. And pretty soon, you know, I mean, you're not going to be able, it's already to the point where you really can't go anywhere in the city without being, without your picture being taken either by private security cameras or by public security cameras, you know, the NYPD. But this was just going to make that whole situation exponentially worse. So that was another reason that I sort of turned against the congestion pricing plan. And then finally, the thing which it sort of like dawned on me, you know, it should have been very obvious, but like I say, you know, I'm saving this one for last because it's the most insidious. It's like so, it should be so obvious, and yet it doesn't immediately occur to you until you start thinking about it, is the privatization angle. Right? Charging people to come into Manhattan is just one step towards turning Manhattan, one step closer to turning Manhattan into a private theme park where you have to, you know, you have to pay money to get in, just like Disneyland. And, you know, it's one step closer to just turning it into a simulacrum of its former self, into a completely commodified and privatized, you know, Manhattan land. That's the most insidious thing about it. And once again, this is something which, you know, it's so subtle and insidious that you don't even notice, you know, but there's a whole sort of shift in our consciousness which has taken place, which begins to enter official language. Now, apropos of what we're talking about, they broke ground on the high-rise that they that they've been wanting to build for a long time directly across the street from me. And this morning, when they were working with their power drill, my building was shaking violently. And it's an old building. You know, it's more than a century old. And I was really afraid that it was going to suffer from structural damage. So I called 311, and I call 311 fairly frequently, because if it isn't one thing, it's another. You know, the heat goes out, the water goes out, hot water goes out, etc. But today it was because of the building shaking due to the construction going on across the street. So I called 311, and you know, it's always such a disturbing experience to call 311. For a number of reasons. I mean, for starters, you know, back before 311, you would actually, I mean, if you were savvy enough, I mean, I understand 311 streamlines things, and if you're not savvy enough, then it's easy. There's just one number to call. But if you're, you know, a longtime resident who's, you know, been fighting your landlord for a long time, and you know the bureaucracy, back before 311, you know, you could actually call the buildings department directly, call HPD directly, you know, call the fire department directly, call the environmental control board directly. And, you know, today, it's very difficult to even get those numbers. And if you call them, they're very suspicious and they're like, oh, why are you calling us? Why don't you just call 311? So, and of course, if you call 311, then, you know, there's a whole other, it's difficult enough to make your way around the bureaucracy. This is a bit of a tangent. But if you call 311, there's a whole other, you know, layer of bureaucracy you have to deal with. The 311 bureaucracy, they've got to figure out, you know, which way to route your call. You know, which bureaucracy it is, you know, which agency of the bureaucracy it is which needs to address your problem. And I understand that that does make things more convenient for some people because it saves you the hassle of having to do your work, of having to do that work. But anyway, this is a bit of a tangent. The really insidious thing about 311 is, for starters, they refer to the people who call as customers, not as citizens, but as customers. Does anybody else out there get the implications of that? And then at the end of the call, you know, they talk about, you know, the customer complaint number. What's up with that? We aren't customers. We're citizens. We're not buying a service. This is a service which is a public entitlement that we're calling for, you know, whether it's, you know, enforcement on, you know, landlord failing to upkeep the building or, you know, some kind of public nuicance or whatever it is, you know, you aren't calling some, you know, private business. You're calling the city of New York, of which you are a citizen. Customer complaint number? Excuse me? And then at the end of the call, they say, thank you for calling New York City. As if we had a choice. What city are we supposed to call? Should I call Oshkosh? Should I call Boston? Should I call Atlanta? I'm in New York City. Of course I'm going to call New York City. Thank you for calling New York City, as if it was a private business. It's not a private business. It's a city. Okay, we aren't customers. We're citizens. But thank you for calling New York City implies that, you know, we're just customers and we could just shop around and take our business elsewhere. And, of course, that's ultimately what they would like. They would like us to, you know, shop around and take our business elsewhere. And if we're tough customers, well, you know, maybe we should just go elsewhere, right? That's ultimately the implication. Am I just being paranoid here, or is there like a real profound, you know, cultural shift which has taken place, which is manifesting itself in language? And what scares me is that, you know, it only seems surreal to me because I'm an old guy, and the kids who are growing up today are not even going to really, they're going to have a fundamentally altered notion of what citizenship means. And it's not like, you know, we ever voted on this. This is something which is just sort of, you know, being done without any public input. Right? I mean, fortunately, the congestion pricing plan was beaten back, albeit for the wrong reasons. You know, it was beaten back. I shouldn't say entirely the wrong reasons, because I think that at least the class angle did play into the public backlash against it. But I think that a lot of it was also people just being wedded to their automobiles, which is a really, really bad reason to be against it. But, all right. I mean, I shouldn't paint the picture as too dark. But, because, you know, there is, I mean, look, I'm still spewing about it on the radio, and people did, you know, shut down the city council chambers during the vote on the 125th Street rezoning. So, okay, there still is some, you know, there still are some glimmers of hope out there. There's still some glimmers of resistance. But let's see. Okay, have you seen these ads around, particularly around Lower Manhattan now, for very, very insidious ads for Rolling Rock Beer? And the name Rolling Rock doesn't appear anywhere on the ad. But it's a picture of the Rolling Rock logo on the moon. And the text says, get ready for moonvertising. Go to www.moonvertising.org. And there's an image of the logo of Rolling Rock Beer being projected with lasers onto the moon. Now, fortunately, this is just a scam. Fortunately, this is just a gimmick, and there really isn't any moonvertising. And it's just a way of, you know, making people, of drawing people in And making, you know, it's one of these weird sort of postmodern ads where they don't even mention the name of the product that they're trying to sell because, oh, that's just so 20th century, you know. Today we're so much hipper than that. So it's one of these, you know, weird ways of like subtly getting you to like buy Rolling Rock beer. Well, thank goodness that's all it is. But once again, I think that there's something much more insidious going on here, which is that, you know, they're getting us ready. They're getting us psychologically ready for moonvertising. And the baby, you know, 5 or 10 or 20 years from now, or hell, for all I know, 5 or 10 or 20 days from now, they're going to be, they really are going to be projecting corporate logos up onto the moon. And all over the world, people are going to be looking up at the moon. You know, lovers and poets and artists and musicians are going to be looking up to the moon for inspiration, as they have, as we human beings have, as long as we've been around on the planet, and they're going to be looking at the logo of Rolling Rock Beer. Or, you know, Exxon or Mobil or Camel Cigarettes or whatever it happens to be. So, now, this raises the question of who owns the moon? Now, I think the Outer Space Treaty says that nobody owns the moon, right? And yet, you know, Neil Armstrong did plant the flag up there in spite of that. And now they're talking about moonvertising. So this raises the question of who owns the moon. And even if, you know, no nation state can claim the moon under the Outer Space Treaty, which I believe is the case. I need to check up on that. Don't quote me. You know, who owns the image of the moon as seen from the Earth? So, you know, creeping privatization reaches into the heavens. And, okay, you know, all of these, you've noticed that supermarkets are closing all over the city. So, you know, this is kind of like the enclosure of food. And if you notice, you know, there's food riots going on all over the planet, most recently in Somalia. Just yesterday, there was pretty ugly violence in Mogadishu, people protesting over the fact they don't have food. Well, you know, it's all moving so quickly that it's quite scary. And one of the ways which it's manifesting here in New York City is supermarkets are closing. You know, the places where, you know, ordinary, you know, working residents in this city go to shop aren't going to be here anymore. And they're being, you know, in their place, you know, fancy nightclubs and bars are opening up, or, chain pharmacies like Walmart or whatever are opening up. Not Walmart. What's the chain pharmacy that's sprouting up all over the city like mushrooms? Was it CVS? The point is either, you know, corporate chain joints or else, yuppie bars for the elites, you know, yuppie bars and nightclubs and high-end restaurants for the elites. So, you know, food itself is becoming not a human right, but sort of a privilege of the elites. The right to eat is sort of becoming a privilege of the elites. And the notion that there's any kind of, you know, human right to food is sort of being viewed with contempt. It's sort of being viewed as a old-fashioned, backward-looking, socialistic, reactionary idea. So you've got the sort of the privatization of food, which is going on, the privatization of the right to food. It's no longer perceived as something which is, you know, due to the public. But meanwhile, well, you know, if you can't afford to buy food, well, that's it's too bad for you, right? So then we've got the next starts. We've got the privatization of food. We've got the privatization, or I should say, privatization of, you know, food distribution. It's already in private hands, but this is one step further towards actually making it entirely the province of the elites. And that the private entities which control it, you know, are further abdicating any sense of responsibility to the public. That's what I mean by privatization of food, because, of course, it's already in private hands. So now we've got the privatization of the moon, and we've got the, you know, creeping privatization generally of New York City. Then we've got, congestion pricing was sold to us as a cure for traffic congestion in New York City, and was sold to us in sort of progressive guise. And similarly, you know, the sort of the enclosure of public space into semi-privatized space, these sort of like mall type things, is also often being sold to us as creating car-free zones and so on, which of course is the co-optation of a good idea. Once again, the co-optation of a good idea in progressive guise. We're, being sold these like semi-privatized spaces, and these semi-privatized communities. Well, similarly, one of the very popular measures against global warming right now is so-called pollution credits or carbon trading, where essentially if a utility cleans up its act beyond what the regulations require, then it gets pollution credits, which it can sell to another utility, which will then give it the right to pollute in excess of what the standards allow. So this strikes me as the creeping privatization of air, right? The atmosphere is being privatized, and the right to degrade it is being sold back and forth on the open market. Of course, the way the system works, it's going to be in the poorest areas where you've got the utilities which are going to be buying the pollution credits. And it's going to be in the richest areas where the utilities are going to be selling the pollution credits. So, the air in the poorer areas is going to get more and more difficult to breathe. And pretty soon the people in the richer areas are going to want to protect their air. And they're going to start building plastic domes over the city. So this is where I see all of this going. I think that, 20 years from now, there's going to be a giant dome over Manhattan Island. And there's not going to be anybody here but the rich, and they're all going to be living under, a giant dome. It's going to be like one of these futuristic science fiction scenarios, but you can actually see it in embryo now. We are headed towards, the Buckminster Fuller sort of prophesized it again as a sort of, this very visionary, 1960s kind of idea that in the future we'll be able to control the climate under domed cities, but instead it's going to be something which is going to be absolutely dystopian. And it's going to be, the ultra elites are going to be withdrawing into their privatized, domed fortress cities, where they're, going to be endlessly entertained with all of their high-tech gadgetry, while the rest of us are going to be left outside the dome dodging bullets in the toxic waste. That's where I see it all headed. Now, is there anybody out there who thinks that I am completely paranoid and just way off base? Well, I'd really love to hear from you, so please do give me a call. In just around 5 minutes, we'll take phone calls at 212-209-2900, 212-209-2900, but not now. We're going to play a little bit of music. Then I'm going to come back, and we're going to do just one or two announcements, and then we'll maybe play a little bit more music, and then we'll take listener phone calls. So here, there's a song I want to play, which is on the theme which we've been discussing, which is the privatization of everything, the privatization of known reality, and beginning with the privatization of language, the privatization of the English language, its takeover by private commercial interests. So let's give it up for Lena Horne. Thank you.
Napoleon's a pastry. Bismarck is a herring. Alexander's a cream de coco mixed with rum. And Herbie Hoover is a vacuum. Columbus is a circle and a day off. Pershing is a square, what a payoff. Julius Caesar is just a salad on a shell. So, little brother, get wise to yourself. Life's a bowl and it's full of cherry pits. Play it big and it throws you for a loop. That's the way with fate. Comes today with great cons. Tomorrow with tomato soup. Napoleon's a pastry. Get this under your brow. What once used to be a rooster is just a duster now. Napoleon's a pastry. Dubarry is a lipstick. Pompadour's a hairdo. Good Queen Mary just floats along from pier to pier. Venus de Milo is a pink brassiere. Sir Gladstone is a bag, it is shocking. And the mighty Kaiser, just a stocking. The Tsar of Russia is now a jar of caviar. And Cleopatra is a black cigar. Yes, my honey lamb, Swift is just a ham. Lincoln's a tunnel, Coolidge is a dam. Yes, my noble lads, comes today with fads. Comes tomorrow we all subway ads. Homer is just a swat. Get this under your brow. All these big wig controversials are just commercials now. Better get your jug of wine and loaf of love before that final vow. Napoleon's a pastry. Caesar is a salad. Get it while you able.
All right. Lena Horne, the song Napoleon on the privatization of the English language. Napoleon's a pastry from the musical comedy Jamaica, 1957. Don't know much about it, but the song was provided to me from the archives of the Rudy Blesch Ragtime Society as being one which would be topically appropriate to what I was going to be talking about tonight. And let's see here. Okay, announcements. First, and just two announcements. Just give two announcements, and we'll take phone calls. It's 1 o'clock in the morning. I'm listener-supported, non-commercial, WBAI, 99.5 FM in New York City, which I fear is shortly to become New York City Incorporated. But meanwhile, enjoy while you can. This is one of the few institutions which is still available for the social benefit as a temporary autonomous zone, if you will. WBAI. We're on the air for the love of it. We're not on the air for money. I'm certainly not on the air for money. I'm not making any money by being here. So this is one institution which continues to exist outside the profit system. And this is all by way of saying, remember, next week we're going to be doing a fund drive to keep this station on the air. Now, a fund drive is not the same thing as advertising or selling products. When we give out the premiums, that's just a little bit of icing on the cake to get you to do what you should be doing anyway, which is supporting. I know I shouldn't use that word should. Oh, no, I just used it twice. I said I shouldn't use the word should. You know what I'm saying. It's just in your own enlightened self-interest to keep WBAI happy and healthy, or at least alive, right? So please do, if you can afford anything at all, please do help us out in our fund drive next week. That's the first announcement. Because it's not about the money here. It's not about the money. It's about love and passion here at WBAI. And the reason we ask you for money is because we don't sell advertising. And we don't sell your ears to advertisers for money, right? That's not what we're about here at WBAI. Fundamentally, not what we're about. So that means that we have to ask you to support us, again, simply out of love and passion. Just like I come down here and I talk into this microphone every week out of love and passion. Well, you know, you've got to send us some money out of love and passion so that the station can continue to be here for you and can continue to survive. Okay, so that's the first announcement. Just a warning. Now, I philosophically believe that it is incumbent upon me as a producer to give you good radio, despite the fact that we're having a fun drive, and not merely to monotonously repeat the fun line telephone number in mantra-like fashion over and over and over again. So I will actually be producing some good programming, I hope. So do join us, please, but please be ready to give what you can, okay? That's all, just what you can. That's all we're asking. Okay, also next Tuesday, 1 week from tonight, I am going to be doing my presentation at the Anarchist Forum entitled The Civil Resistance in Iraq. I've given this presentation several times, but I'm giving it again. So if you haven't seen it yet, this is going to be your opportunity. And, of course, there's going to be updates. A lot has changed. A lot of very interesting developments, actually, recently. I mean, you probably on May Day, you're probably aware, the ILWU longshoremen out on the West Coast, they shut down every port on the West Coast from San Diego to Seattle in protest of the occupation of Iraq. And they were joined by the General Council of Dock Worker Unions in Iraq, who shut down the port in Basra in solidarity with the ILWU. So there are actually some real glimmers of hope on the landscape, on the generally very, very grim picture of Iraq. There's actually, you know, the alliances which need to be built between, say, organized labor here and in Iraq against the occupation are actually starting to come together. So I'm going to be giving an update on this, as well as showing the video produced by my comrades in Japan about the Iraq civil resistance, 1 week from tonight, a video and discussion on the Iraq Freedom Congress, IFC, a new alliance of trade unions, women's organizations, neighborhood assemblies, and student groups opposed to both the U.S. occupation and the sectarian militias. So I really urge all of our listeners who, if you're not already familiar with this movement, this vitally important movement, which really needs our support, and the important work which is being done in Iraq and here as well, to build, you know, ties of human solidarity with the people who are under occupation and are fighting back for a free and secular state. Please do show up. This is going to be 1 week from tonight. It's going to be May 13th at the Living Theater. That's where the Anarchist Forum is held, at the Living Theater. The Living Theater is at 21 Clinton Street, which is just south of Houston on the Lower East Side. And it's going to be starting at, what time, 7 or 7.30? Does it say? 7 p.m., yes. 7 p.m., 1 week from tonight, May 13th. the Civil Resistance in Iraq with me, Bill Weinberg, at the Living Theater, 21 Clinton Street, which is just south of Houston. If you want more information, call the Libertarian Book Club at 212-792-8050. That's 212-792-8050. And once again, that's 21 Clinton Street, 7 p.m., 1 week from tonight, next Tuesday the 13th. Just a block south, like half a block south of Houston Street on the Lower East Side. So, you know, you can take the F train to Second Avenue and walk down from Houston Street, or get off at Delancey and Essex and walk up. So, up to you. So, let's see. And then let's see what else we got going on here. Oh, yeah, the day after that, I'll have a chance to announce this again next week, but the day after that, our friends Mac McGill and Steve Wishnia are going to be playing at a benefit for World War III Illustrated magazine at Think Coffee, which is at 248 Mercer Street at 8 p.m. the 14th, next Wednesday, a week from tomorrow. So I'll have a chance to announce that again. Hopefully I'll remember, but I'm announcing it now. So you've checked out their work over these airwaves, you longtime listeners. Now's your chance to check them out live if you have not yet done so. Benefit for World War III Illustrated, spoken word, music, and, of course, images, multimedia presentation. Going to be next week, the 14th, at Think Coffee, 248 Mercer Street, up the block from the Angelica Theater at 8 p.m. And with that, we're going to plunge boldly into the unknown and take some listener phone calls at 212-209-2900. 212-209-2900 is the number. 212-209-2900. Please try to stay on topic and concise. WBAI, you're on the air.
Hi. This is Shane. If you don't mind, maybe we can talk about nuclear disarmament for a minute before going into New York. Is that all right?
Well, what is nuclear disarmament to do with what we're talking about?
It actually has to do with what Hillary Clinton was talking about, you know, obliterating Iran and this and that.
Yeah, well, that's very sinister. We understand.
Yeah. Well,
unfortunately, both of the Democratic candidates feel that they have to engage in this kind of rhetoric. I mean, Obama has said similar things. Actually, he didn't actually use the word obliterate, but he did talk about, you know, go in and unilaterally bombing Pakistan if they don't go after Al Qaeda. So it's really, really, it's a sign of the times how far things have gone in the wrong direction since the Reagan era that both of the Democratic candidates feel they have to engage in this kind of rhetoric. Very sinister.
Yeah. Yes, I'm not, basically rooting for Obama or anybody else. I'm rooting for the principle of disarmament. But in any event, on WBAI, a Jewish lady called in one of the programs, and she gave out the number, which it wouldn't hurt to give out. This is not 311. Hillary's number, 212-688-6262. 212-688-6262. And she said that she called, and she said that she's Jewish, and she's outraged that Hillary should even entertain the thought that this would sit in well with some...
Well, good. Glad to hear it, but it's kind of obvious, and it's not what we're talking about tonight. So
I understand. Okay. We were talking about paranoia, right? Paranoia in New York. This is far more serious paranoia in New York. In any event, I did call the number, and then I... made the same point, and apparently there's only one guy attending this, on that day, he was the only person, and he tried to defend the position and this and that.
Well, I'm sure that he did, but it's not what we're talking about tonight. Okay.
Do you think this is important enough?
I think it's important, but it's not what we're talking about tonight.
I am, okay.
I mean, can you wrap it up real quick?
The idea is when he tried to defend it, saying this is a last option, the last resort, whatever. I said, this sounds like saying that, okay, you know, suppose I say to you that I would criticize Hillary Clinton, but if it didn't work, then as a last resort, I would just have to assassinate her.
I wouldn't even say that kind of thing
over the air in jest.
I wouldn't even say that over the air in jest. You're not paranoid enough, man. Get more paranoid. WBAI, you're on the air. Hello? Hello?
Hi.
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 Okay, hi.
Oh, I'm on the air, okay.
That's the point, yes.
Okay, sorry, I was having feedback. I had to turn off my radio.
Please turn down the radio, yes.
I just did, okay. Well, good morning.
Good morning.
And this is an interesting topic, privatization of New York City. Your dome idea or speculation is interesting. I don't know if... you know, if the rich or the people existing at that point in time will want a dome over something like what they're doing in Japan already.
Right. In Japan, they've actually got, you know, like indoor beaches. They've actually created a natural environment indoors. You know, it's like the biosphere experiment out in the Southwest, which did not work. Well, they're actually, you know, they're doing stuff like that in Japan. You can actually go to an indoor beach where they've got like this pseudo ocean and
Right. And Japan is experiencing a lot of problems still, social problems. And it's a beautiful place to visit, but they have their own things they got to sort out with a society that's really highly educated. And if that's the way we're going, you know, there's, we can decide today, like, for example, I'm poor. I'm a poor person, educated but poor. And I can decide, I myself right now can decide how I'm going to handle the fact that I might not be able to live in New York in about 10 years from now. I was born and raised in New York. That this is all I know. So how am I going to handle that? So what I can do as a poor person, perhaps going into middle class by educating myself in college and going further with my education, is perhaps get together with other people in my same economic bracket and really unify. Because I'll tell you one thing, where, you know, there's a lot of you know, I agree with what you're saying and what you're projecting for the next, 30 years probably, you're projecting, or 50 years. I mean, I could definitely see that's really possible, what you're saying. But what I don't see is really this very weak, you're kind of like even emphasizing more how weaker let's say the labor market, the labor, not the blue-collar worker, is, I don't think the blue-collar worker is as weak as what you're saying here in New York City, at least within the tri-state area, five boroughs, which is where I'm at. I think we're a lot stronger than what you make us to be, or not you, but private New York City, privatization of New York City, corporations, New York City, Wall Street, Midtown Manhattan, and let's say already the pushing in of Long Island City and Park Slope, the privatization of people's interest in these neighborhoods to privatize the entire five boroughs for some reason. Who would support? My question is, perhaps you can answer, who would support this rich segment of New York City that is to be, like we're projecting might be? Because my understanding is that I'm being paid a very low salary, even though I'm college educated, so that somebody can stay rich. You see, I'm at $40,000, which is a very meager salary in New York City. Really doesn't cut it for much rent, but let's say $40,000, right? I'm supposed, instead of me earning $60,000 with a lot of experience right now, 60, 55, 60, even 65, let's say I'm literally only earning $40,000 so that my manager and the doctor that I work for can stay rich, so that they can all get together with other people that earn $200,000 a year and create business in New York City for me, for the lower income people to come and work and survive somehow. Now, if I go into a lawsuit, let's say, potentially, which I have the power to do so, either with a lawyer or pro se, right? If I go into a lawsuit to say, I'm supposed to be at $55,000. There's some sort of inequality going on here, and I need to fight it out in court. Let's just hypothetically say I do that, and anyone can do that really here in New York City. So, I get $65,000, and then let's say it's a class action lawsuit where they find that there's some sort of treatment that's going on that is illegal, might be proven illegal in some hypothetical theoretical sense, and there's more salary paid out. So then that's less money for a corporation at the end of the budget fiscal year.
Okay, so? All right, so
do you get my idea? Do you see where I'm going?
Well, is this something you're advocating that New Yorkers do?
Yeah, I am advocating.
Well,
I'm strongly advocating that I'm strong. I'm always advocating.
Look, people come in and, they call in with all these great ideas, but, they expect somebody else to pick up the ball and run with it. Go ahead and do it.
Well, I can't expect anyone else to fight the fight for me because, to tell you the truth, I challenge anybody that's listening, anybody tomorrow that wakes up and says, yeah, let me try it out, what she's saying. I challenge five lawyers, any lawyer, employment lawyer, personal injury lawyer, corporate lawyer, criminal lawyer, just call five lawyers.
Yeah,
civil lawyers.
And
find out, this is the test of who is really defending this privatization of New York City? Who's really pushing for it? And I guarantee you, 99% of who's leading this privatization, what you're calling privatization, which I agree with, of New York City, are the lawyers, are private attorneys in civil cases. Now, if we're advocating, this is what I'm getting from you too, that privatization is not going to be in the interest of the low-income, middle-income person, such as myself.
To say the least, but I think you're misidentifying the enemy here. And a minute ago, you were just talking about fighting back through the legal system. So I'm not following your argument at all.
I don't consider the attorney the enemy. I consider the attorney the instrument of what is being used to privatize the instrument.
All right, so what are you advocating here?
Advocating is that as New York City needs to, as before, as how this country was founded, as taxes are issued, the sense of community
what's the tactic which you're, I'm not quite sure where you're going with this. What's the tactic which
I'm going with the fact, well, really one question. I do have one question I'm calling with. Who's going to support this privatization? Who's going to be the labor force? The labor market,
that is sort of an Achilles heel in the whole thing, one hopes, is that, they are still going to need somebody to, be their chauffeurs and to cook for them and to clean their toilets and so on. They are going to need a labor force to do that. So, maybe they'll come up with a pass system so they can let people into the plastic dome. But,
right, but how much are they going to get paid?
Right, probably very little. But, they're going to argue.
Then how are the rents? Because there's about to be a rent increase again.
Yeah, I know. But, they'll have a pass system to get into the plastic dome. They'll be living outside of the plastic dome. They're not going to be living in the enclosed area. But, your legal thesis there, I'm not quite sure I'm getting it, because you're going to have a hard time proving it is actually, discriminatory practices going on, unless you can find other people in a similar position who are making considerably more.
Right. Well, the thing is to go ahead and do it. You have to go through the system.
Yeah, but you can't do it unless you've got a case. Otherwise, you know, no lawyer is going to take it unless you've got a case.
Well, anybody in the legal system, anybody can sue anybody, and anybody can take anything to court.
You can get sued for bringing frivolous litigation. I'm not sure this is exactly the way we want to proceed. I think probably, you know, organizing citywide rent strike might be a better idea. WBAI, you're on the air. Hello.
Hi, this is WBAI.
It certainly is. I probably just got myself put on a landlord's blacklist by saying that. But, yes, this is WBAI. You're on the air.
Okay. I guess I'm calling with kind of a reaction to listening a little bit to your show, and it's probably a little bit of a reaction to WBAI in general. I struggle sometimes with some of the messages that I hear from WBAI because I think I would like to say that I'm pretty aligned with, you know, a lot of the principles of the radical left. But do you think that using sort of such extreme hyperbole, I mean, like this idea of, you know, this plastic dome and, you know, people, you know, everybody else is going to be on the outside and the toxic waste dodging bullets. I feel like I hear things like that and then you kind of lose me, you know?
Well, look, I mean, I sort of began taking phone calls saying that I hoped somebody was going to call in and chastise me for being paranoid. So thank
you.
Which
is why I called in. I'm driving back from the airport, so I'm kind of losing the radio. I can't really hear so much of what you're saying now.
Thank you for telling me that I'm paranoid because it's comforting. But I have to say that, you know, I do see it in embryo, in this congestion pricing plan, in, you know, in Citi Field and IKEA bus line, I see it in embryo. You know, I do. I'm just extrapolating if trends continue, this is the direction that I see things going, unfortunately.
Do you think that there's a way to help this message reach a broader audience? By kind of, you know, helping to almost identify, okay, and we recognize that this message around this idea of this dome may sound pretty far out, but sort of here's the supporting data, here's our, you know, assessment of the current situation that supports this, you know, otherwise pretty radical sounding idea. Because I'm afraid that there's a lot of people out there that are like me that, you know, want to be aligned with these kind of ideas and then hear that and can just kind of maybe unfairly write it off as kind of a crackpot theory. And maybe that's not fair.
Yeah, well, you know, I hate to say it, but a lot of science fiction, you know, a lot of future fiction of the past has come true, right? I mean, you know, notoriously, you know, Jules Verne anticipated nuclear submarines a century before we had them. And, you know, certainly all too much of what Orwell wrote about in 1984 has actually come to pass. Certainly the level of surveillance is damn near what he actually depicted in his book that he wrote in 1948. So, you know, again, I hope that I'm just being paranoid and alarmist, but I wouldn't have said it if there wasn't the part of me which actually feels that, yes, this is the direction that it's all headed.
All right. I don't know. Just good luck with kind of getting that message out to enough of a broad audience.
Okay.
So I just wonder if some kind of tailoring of that might help it reach a
little
bit
of a
broader audience.
Well, look, another thing to keep in mind is that it's, you know, almost 1:30 in the morning on a Tuesday night. So this is the show where we can afford to, you know, get a little bit experimental.
That's fair.
Not tailor the message, which is what they do from, you know, 6 o'clock in the morning until 6 in the evening. You know,
okay.
And actually, I would argue that much of what you hear on the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade in the late night programming is in fact a lot less extremist and alarmist than what you would hear during some of the shows during the day. All right, thanks for your call. We're going to see if we can try to squeeze in one or two more. WBAI, you're on the air. We have very little time left, so keep it short.
I don't know what you think about direction. What are you talking about here? Why are you trying to scare everyone half to death?
Okay, another caller says, I'm paranoid.
You don't know.
WBAI, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hello.
Yeah, it's a very good program. I'll make it quick. I know you're pressed for time. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal, which is hardly called a left-wing publication, February 13th of 2007, a little more than a year ago. And somebody writes in the op-ed column how he calls superstar cities New York, Boston, L.A., and San Francisco. I'll repeat, New York, Boston, L.A., and San Francisco. As where they only want three kinds of people. Number one is the very well-to-do. Number two is the university intellectuals. like with PhDs and masters and lawyers or whatever. And number three would be the what they call the avant-garde or the vanguard, not just a person in a field, but the top people in whatever field, like not just a fashion model in Soho, but the top fashion models. Not just a restaurateur, Italian restaurateur, but the top Italian restaurateur, etc. And essentially, if you're not part of any of these three categories, you could either get lost or drop dead. Remember, this is the Wall Street Journal.
Thank you. Okay, paranoia vindicated. Let's move on. WBAI, you're on the air. Not much time. Keep it brief.
Okay. I called in last week to speak to the BAI directorship, and I suggested BAI do a whole day's programming on exactly what you were talking about tonight. And I'm requesting that other listeners do the same. The suggestion was received fairly well, and I think it's important to do all-day special programming on gentrification and housing. And if anybody thinks you're paranoid, go down and look at the Bowery on Friday night.
Touche. I second that concept. I think an all-day programming special about issues of how New York City is changing would be imperative. WBAI, you're on the air. Keep it brief. Not much time.
Okay. All I have to say is lawsuits, lawsuits, lawsuits. Everyone must file lawsuits.
Over what? Over what? Over what?
Over everything and anything.
Like what?
Because they're pushing hard. We got to push back.
Okay. Like what?
Lawsuits, lawsuits, lawsuits.
Oh, come on.
Lawsuits.
Like what? Like what? What do you want to
like
sue us?
Like everything and anything.
Oh,
under
come
the
on. I'm asking you, can you give us one specific?
Go pro se. In federal court, Supreme Court, appeals, Court of Appeals.
Okay, no. Over what issues? Contest what in the courts?
Well, if you're talking about privatization, then you need to file private lawsuits of corporate law or housing laws or employment laws. You have to file lawsuits in every type of legal entity, legal aspect that you can get in order to not get pushed out of New York City. You gotta file lawsuits.
Well, I mean, yeah, sometimes in order to keep your home, you do have to take your landlord to court. Yes, this is...
You have to take them to court.
Yes.
You have to file a lawsuit. If you're being discriminated at work, you have to file a lawsuit.
Okay, now you're talking about specifics. Thank you.
That's right. Okay. Thank you.
All right, let's see if we can squeeze in one more. WBAI, you're on the air. Not much time.
Hi, yeah,
you're on the air.
Yeah, I just think that we should just circle all these new high rises and just stop them. I think it should be a huge revolt. People complain.
Okay, you're going to organize it?
I would love to.
Tell me.
I've been going around to the construction sites and I say, "What are you digging down there? Are you making us swimming pools?"
All right. Well, listen.
The further down that they dig, the more the mud and the gunk and it's just not, it's not secure enough to build these.
All right. Tell me when the meeting is. I'll be there. Call us back when you got the meeting.
So
I'll be there.
You could start with 86 in Lexington.
Uh-huh.
I go by there all the time. Most people do say it's absolutely ridiculous.
All right. We're going to try to squeeze in one call. WBAI, you're on the air. Last call, quick. Do you know what quick means?
Yeah.
Yeah, quick.
Not too long ago, there was an episode of 30 Rock where a young writer and his girlfriend were looking at some real estate in Manhattan, and she convinced him to get a posh apartment on the Upper East Side, and he said he couldn't afford it. Anyway, he got a promotion. So the real estate agent takes him there, and he says, okay, we'll buy it, you know, like $1.2 million. And just then, when the real estate agent sticks her hand out to congratulate him, another agent opens the door with an Arab sheik walks in and he says, "We'll take this apartment too. My son can park his motorcycles in it." And walks out and she says, "Sorry, you've just been outbid."
Okay. Well, you know, unfortunately, frequently there has to be the gratuitous xenophobia play whenever there's any kind of reference of or invocation of class resentment in this society, which is...
Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.